Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of the great folks at www.patriotfamilies.com. Some of whom are with us in the chat room tonight and hopefully are out there listening in. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is student behaviors and our failing public schools. I have a question for those of you out there listening. If you were in a classroom, what would you assume to be the appropriate behavior while you were there? Would you consider it to be sticking pencils up your nose, eraser end first, and grinning at the other students? Would you consider throwing things from desk to desk to be appropriate behavior? Would you consider speaking out with personal questions to the teacher while that teacher is attempting to explain something as appropriate behavior? Would you think that cursing a teacher because the teacher has asked you to sit down in your seat instead of walking about the classroom, appropriate behavior? Well, apparently, there are many students out there in our public schools who believe that these behaviors are appropriate, and they feel absolutely no compunctions in showing them. Spend a great deal of time blaming our teachers, our administrators, unions, and the federal government for the declining state of our public schools, but we always seem to forget that public schools aren't just those students, they're also students. And in order for anyone to learn, there has to be a two-way street. There has to be teaching, and there has to be learning. And learning doesn't happen when your mouth is open and garbage is coming out. Learning only happens when your mouth is closed and your ears and your mind are open. But our public school systems, because of their reliance on governmental regulations and governmental money, have basically made these kinds of behaviors acceptable and suitable to be accommodated under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Almost anything is now classified as a disability. And if it is classified as a disability, according to the federal government's Department of Education and its application of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, as it pertains to education, anyone with a disability of any kind must be accommodated reasonably. And all students in public schools should be entitled to a free, appropriate public education. Now, the word appropriate in there doesn't mean appropriate behavior or appropriate content or appropriate age specific skills. It means appropriate according to the child's opinion as expressed by the parent. I had a student in ISS yesterday who repeatedly talked out, got up out of his chair, picked up things that didn't belong to him, refused to do what he was required to do. In all, basically violated just about every one of the rules that are in place in the ISS classroom. And his final act was the happy little pencils in the nose, grinning at the other students. I had moved his seating arrangements twice so that he was not poking, prying, and throwing things at other people. And the final arrangement had him against the wall, and he turned around and inserted the pencils to make everybody else in the room laugh. I removed him from class with a referral and sent him to the main office. He was kept there until the end of school, came and picked up his things, and got 3 days of out-of-school suspension. It took about 3.5 hours of this kind of behavior for me to be justified in removing him from my classroom. And only because my classroom has rules that are sanctioned by our administrators. The regular teachers in our school are not allowed to set rules like mine. Because the fact that my students have to raise the hand before they speak, that they must remain seated while they're in class, they must do the work assigned to them, and they may ask for help but are required to raise their hand before they talk out, are considered to be punishment rules. Because my in-school suspension room is punishment. In regular classrooms, they're not punished this way. Looks like I have a caller on the line, folks. Let's see if they have something to contribute about the effective behavior on education. Hello. Can you hear me?
Is this the line?
Hello there. This is Terry Rowland. And who am I speaking with?
You're speaking with Felix.
Felix?
Edith.
Nice. I'm glad you called, Felix. Do you have something to contribute about your view of students' role in public education?
Yes. I just have to say, are you craving my McNuggies?
For the interruption, ladies and gentlemen. Apparently, the gentleman isn't interested in contributing to the discussion. Anyway, one of the reasons that we have difficulties with our public schools and it's only one of the many, many reasons we have difficulties, is that we have taken the idea of accommodating a person with disabilities to absolutely absurd lengths. We have made it impossible for children in a classroom to have a positive learning environment. Whenever we set ourselves up to make the least productive and the most disruptive student the focus of our attention, we end slitting our own national throat. Because engaging in this kind of accommodation rewards inappropriate behavior. It rewards the inability to learn. It rewards socially unacceptable attitudes and actions. And it creates as a standard a nation of people who cannot think, will not think, and cannot and will not work at anything. What was originally a genuinely compassionate belief that everyone is entitled to the opportunity to learn has been warped out of all recognition to everyone is entitled to have anything they want simply because they exist, and that the entire world is going to bow down and worship them because they are. Not any particular thing, just that they are. Granted, is the responsibility of governments and the liberal college professors who teach teachers how to teach, and our unwillingness to stray from the politically correct path that has created a climate in which this kind of behavior goes unpunished or uncorrected. But this can be countered, ladies and gentlemen, by the parents of these kids. But they aren't countering it. They are feeding into it. I had a student in ISS today who was having difficulty with his math. He had been given a quiz to do the day before, and he was unable to complete it because he doesn't like his math teacher and doesn't listen when the math teacher goes over the information. And because he doesn't listen, he doesn't learn how to do the math problems. Well, he doesn't dislike me. So I spent about an hour today helping him understand how to do the problems. It was a struggle for him because he did not ever have anybody actually teach him how to do something. He's had people give him answers his entire life. But he did get it. He did figure it out. It took time, and it took getting away from the, I already know how to do it. You don't have to show me anymore. And doing it wrong four or five times, and then going back and doing it together again. But he did get it. Now, ideally, this particular individual could flourish and do very well at something if he had one-on-one teaching with somebody that he liked. Well, that would be an ideal world. And I think that would be wonderful. But I don't think that you or anybody else out there listening is willing to pay the cost of one-on-one teaching for each of the 600-plus students in the middle school where I work. It is extraordinarily expensive to do one-on-one teaching, ladies and gentlemen. If you are fortunate enough to be wealthy and to be able to afford a governess or tutor, you can help a child who has difficulties to be in a class environment. But we do not have that option in our public schools. We do not even anymore have the option of special education classes where students who have difficulty learning can be with other students who have difficulty learning and have goal setting that is reasonable for what they can do and the pace at which they can do it. We don't have that anymore because having special education courses is considered to be demeaning to the children who are in sped classes. If you segregate, dreadful word, children with learning problems away from children who don't have them, you are making them into second-class citizens. You are harming them. You are damaging self-esteem. They can't be part of the group. They can't enter into the soul of the collective. So you put them in a couple of classes with students who don't have difficulties. And what happens? Do those students who have trouble learning all of a sudden blossom into Rhodes Scholars and young Einsteins? It would be wonderful if they did, but they don't. They do not learn because they cannot keep up with the pace of a normal child's learning ability. They are frustrated. They get angry. And they act in behaviors that completely disrupt the ability of anyone else to learn. I am not blaming the student per se, ladies and gentlemen, because there are people who do have difficulties understanding and learning at an average pace. That is not a choice that they make. It's merely the way they came into the world. But instead of accepting that, and based on the idea that you might need to present material differently or at a slower pace, giving them an environment in which they are not feeling as if they are second-class citizens is somehow wrong, makes no sense. I've worked with SPED students. I've worked as a private tutor. I've taught in the classroom. I'm very familiar with the difficulties that students have, both in my professional capacity and in my personal life. I have a stepdaughter and two grandsons who are attention deficit disorder. My husband is dyslexic. All of those people in my life are very bright and definitely want to learn. But unfortunately, for our current students, they had something that the current special ed student doesn't have. They had parents and teachers who didn't accommodate them and who didn't pat them on the head and say, oh, you can't help it, you don't have to talk. They had parents and teachers who told them the truth, that yes, this is hard, and yes, you're going to have to work harder at it. For one of the members in the chat room who mentioned that ADD doesn't make you sped, actually it does. Attention deficit disorder is considered to be a learning disability, which means that you would have an IEP, which is an individualized education plan, which would include accommodations for your dyslexia in the way that you are tested, or in the way that you are taught, or in the amount of homework that you are given, or in the type of homework you are given, or in whether or not you were allowed to use a computer or had to write things out on paper. If you're going to make a comp, I think you should make one based on knowledge. And yes, you say, but middle, what do you say? aren't alike. Some people are better at things than others. Everybody has someone in the world who's better than they are at what they do. And everybody has somebody in the world who's worse than they are at what they do. It's the nature of being human. The fundamental disconnect between student behaviors and our public schools is that instead of saying that these behaviors are not acceptable and we must do something to correct them, what we do is say these behaviors are just you and it's okay for you to do that and everybody else just has to put up with it. Well, I don't know about all of you out there listening, but I was not brought up to believe that. If I threw a temper tantrum and destroyed things or interrupted my parents' conversation by demands that they pay attention to me or give me something I wasn't supposed to have, or destroyed someone else's property because I didn't like them, nobody patted me on the head and said, "Gee, you poor thing, you can't help it. You have a behavioral disability. We'll just figure out a way to make you not get angry and take you in a corner and give you a treat until you calm down." And if you think that doesn't happen, I should let you talk to my stepdaughter, because that's what they did with my younger grandson. It didn't work. It did not work at all. It was a total failure. Nothing whatsoever encouraging them when you have tantrums and beat up other students, throw desk chairs at the teacher, kick people, because he knew that if he displayed behavior like that, he got to go sit in the corner and avoid doing work and was given a piece of candy while somebody talked nicely to him. We have got to stop accommodating. We have got to stop giving in to the false premise that any behavior is okay because you're okay to be you. That does not work. It does not allow society to function. And it certainly doesn't create prosperity or real freedom. What it creates is chaos. And although that was Marx's end goal in view, even he couldn't figure out how to get past totalitarian control and into the incredible chaos that he believed would allow human beings to evolve into godhood. When we spend 99% of our money and 99% of our time focusing on accommodating behaviors that are socially unacceptable in any environment, let alone a classroom, what are we teaching the children who do not have those behaviors? Are we teaching them that good behavior is an admirable attribute? No, we're not. We're teaching them good behavior. Good behavior doesn't happen. That should be avoided because good behavior doesn't get you. Good behavior gets nothing. Good behavior gets you more wisdom. Good behavior gets you more candy. Good behavior gets you having to stay in class. Good behavior gets you nothing that seems admirable when you're 10, 11, 12 years old. Is this what we want to teach our students? Do we want them to see that the only people who get attention are the ones who act like total jerks? And that this is somehow or other going to make the other kids in the class click their tongues, "Oh, poor thing, he can't help it, I'll just ignore him"? Have you ever been in a group of middle school students when somebody does that? Well, if you haven't, let me enlighten you. No, they don't click their tongues and say, poor little thing, let's ignore him. They laugh uproariously and continue to do the same behavior that the idiot kid is doing. That's what happened in my ISS room. And that's what happens in our classrooms. I am incredibly lucky, ladies and gentlemen, because the students that I have in my classroom, if they misbehave there, according to our school disciplinary policy, I am to remove them, write a referral describing the inappropriate behavior, and they are then sent to the principal's office, and the principal calls their parents, and they are sent home. And if they can't be picked up at that time, they stay in the office until the buses come, and they are sent home with a letter to their parents indicating that they have been suspended from school for 1 to 3 days. Regular classroom teachers can't do this. They have to basically refer a student a minimum of 3 times for disciplinary action more severe than having to sit at a separate table at lunch is instituted. We give these kids so many second, third, fourth, fifth, 75th chances. Discipline is a joke. And since most of the kids wind up getting disciplinary measures, there's an extraordinarily high proportion of them that are special education students in collaborative classes. Because of the frustration that they feel, because they know they cannot do the work that the rest of the class can do. And children want attention, ladies and gentlemen. They desperately need attention from adults. They won't tell you that in so many words. Their behaviors tell you that. And if the only way they can get it is by acting out their frustrations in a way that makes them class clown or look at that, wow, boy, is he cool, that's what they'll do. And that means the teachers in your public schools are spending so much time trying to control a classroom with these kind of behaviors that it's a wonder anybody in there learns anything. I've substitute taught in collaborative classes, ladies and gentlemen. And I've been an aide in a collaborative class very many, many times. In one particular class that I was an aide for a special education student, there were 6 adults in a room with 23 children. There were 2 teachers, one special ed, one general education, and 4 aides. The classroom was a zoo. The teacher could not talk for longer than 30 seconds without somebody shouting out, poking somebody, throwing something, having a tantrum, demanding to go to the bathroom, falling out of their chair. It was chaos. Marx would have been proud. And would you believe, ladies and gentlemen, that that class was civics? Now, if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will. A class that was supposed to teach these students about their country and its government and how it worked, that was so disrupted that nobody learned anything. They spent all their time pasting cut-out pieces of answers onto other pieces of paper or making mobiles or fold-outs, pasting other cut-out pieces of paper onto folded pieces of paper that they were then supposed to take home and study. I don't know whether any of them actually did study. Some of them did. Because, I'd say 50% of the class actually passed because they knew what the material was. The other 25% that passed were basically given the answers to study before they got the test. And they passed with D's. And these children passed to the next grade and did exactly the same thing. And then they went to the next grade and did the same thing. And some of them are graduating from high school this year, having done the same thing for 12 straight years. And they are going to enter the workforce. And you, out there listening, may actually try to hire some of them. And then you are going to have to try to teach them how to do whatever job you've hired them to do. And if it's more complex than pushing a broom, you are going to have a very frustrating time. Consider that fair warning. It is a scandal, and many people have talked about it and ranted and raved about it, the fact that we graduate so many functionally illiterate people. And we do. The reason we graduate functionally illiterate people is that we keep promoting them without actually teaching them anything, because the poor little things can't help it. And we can't make them feel bad by being held back, because they'll be too tall and all their friends are going on without them. Once they're out of our hands and either 16 and quit school or graduate from high school with a certificate of attendance, then we're not responsible for their success or failure anymore. We have nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that they can't feed themselves or afford to live alone or actually keep a job if they're lucky enough to land one. Oh, no. We've graduated them so they'll feel good and they can go out there and be good citizens and sign up for food stamps the minute they graduate from college or high school. If they go to college and play sports, which is the plan of the young gentleman I was trying to teach percentages, he was under the impression that all he has to do is play basketball really well for a college and he will become wealthy and in the NBA. He was incredibly shocked when I told him that if he goes to college, first of all, he has to get in, and secondly, he actually has to take classes while he's there. But of course, if he's good enough at basketball, somebody will take his classes for him and give him the answers, as has happened all through his career so far. And by the way, he is a new student in our school this year who failed sixth grade twice, and when his family moved, they put him in eighth grade in our schools because he's tall and he'll be 16. Yeah. In order to accommodate or protect or feel good, generate, we have told this young man a lie for 8 years of education. We have told him that there is an easy button. We have told him that he's not responsible for putting forth effort to learn. We've told him that knowledge doesn't mean anything. The only thing that matters is whether you can dribble, pass, shoot, do jump shots. That matters in this world. Nothing else does. One of the English papers that he had to work on was a vocabulary development sheet with definitions of words and then sentences that had an incorrect word from that vocabulary list that he had to replace with the correct word. We did that one three times. One of his answers to the question, what part of the world do you think has the best, has the most sublime views? His answer was the Rams and Miami Heat. because to him, viewing basketball on TV is really cool. I explained to him what they meant about a view and had him look at my computer screen with scenes from Austria and New Zealand and the Pacific Islands and so on and so forth. And I said, this is what they mean about where in the world do you think has the most sublime, beautiful, amazing, heavenly things to look at. And then we got there. We got there sort of because he picked Florida because that's where his favorite basketball team is from. These attitudes and behaviors, ladies and gentlemen, don't originate in the school. This kind of attitude originates at home. And the school can't compensate for that or change that if it says, oh, that's great, good answer, and gives him a grade of A on it. Because, oh, that's just him. That's the way he thinks. Can't have individualized self-place, I don't like it, so I don't have to learn freedom in the classroom, and still try to achieve objective standards. We can't do it. We can't accommodate disruptive behaviors and say, oh, it's okay for you to do that because you can't help it, and then complain because everybody else in class isn't learning things the way they should. The whole system is falling apart. And it's falling apart because we're not looking at it clearly and honestly. We're not looking at the effects of all of the things that have brought the school systems down. We are ignoring the fact that accommodating antisocial and disruptive behaviors is not positive educational policy. We're ignoring the fact that you can't have your cake and eat it too and allow children to progress at their own pace and set up academic standards they must meet on a chronological basis. We're ignoring the fact that you are never going to make the playing field level enough so that an IQ of 12 can do the same work as an IQ of 175. And we are never going to make any progress unless we look at the fact that people are not alike, and that's wonderful. And equal doesn't mean alike. And that maybe this kid isn't going to be a college professor, but maybe he'd be really, really good at fixing cars. So let's quit telling him that he should go to college and study automotive engineering when what he really wants to do is get his hands dirty and greasy fixing carburetors. And we have got to stop our love-hate relationship with education and knowledge. Knowledge is a good, ladies and gentlemen. It is not a right. Education is a good. It is not a right. We seek the good things. We do our best to get good things. But there is no law of nature that says we are automatically owed good things from people who have them, without any effort on our part. What we achieve too easily, we value too lightly. This kid has been given answers, and his path has been greased, mainly to get him out of somebody's class because he isn't learning anything. And he's been cheated of whatever education he could possibly get by the progressive lie that making him feel good is the primary function of public schools. For those of you who are not familiar with history and who may not realize or recognize what our public education system or the idea of public education meant to our founding fathers, all of whom were very much in favor of it. It was not intended to be a feel-good paradise. It was not intended to be a social transition mechanism. It was intended to be an opportunity. It's intended to be the chance to make progress, the chance to earn things, the chance to go as far and fly as high as your talents and skills would take you, without barriers put in front of you because you were poor, or because you were from another land, or because you were a new citizen, or because, since the Civil Rights era, you were a race different from those who had been in power. One of the goals, one of the important goals that was a fundamental mover of the Civil Rights Movement was Brown versus the Board of Education, the desegregation of public schools. The chance for young black kids to be able in schools that had up-to-date textbooks, up-to-date technology, good teachers, buildings that were heated and cooled, appropriate to the season, the chance to play intramural sports, the chance to compete on the same basis as white kids because they had the same knowledge given to them. And what did we do with that perfectly reasonable and understandable interpretation of our Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and our Bill of Rights that says all citizens are citizens if they're born here, no matter their previous condition of servitude, their race, etc.? We screwed it up, ladies and gentlemen, because what we did was dumb down the school in a mistaken idea that somehow or other those poor black kids were stupid because they had to go to inferior schools, so they would automatically fail if they went to a good one. So we had to make it easy so they'd feel good about themselves and pass. Again, sheer stupidity. All they ever asked for was a chance to go to the same school and get the same teaching. They didn't ask for a guarantee of an A, for God's sake. They just wanted a good teacher. But oh no, we had to accommodate the you-know-what. And we hurt people. We hurt lots of people. Because we perpetuated the idea that because you belonged to a specific race, you were inherently less capable. We covered it with nice, compassionate-sounding words. But we hurt people. We hurt people, ladies and gentlemen. We hurt them very, very badly because we created a victim mentality. We exacerbated a real wound under the supposed trying to heal it. Instead of doing that, we made it deeper and made it a scar. And we kept it festering when it didn't heal. Because we said, instead of course, you can have the same opportunity because you're a human being too. We didn't say that. We said, oh, we have to make it easy for you because we know that you're stupid and deprived. So we've got to make it easy so you'll feel good and you won't be ashamed of yourself because you just, you know, are too dumb to be able to do what the rest of these kids do. I saw it happen, ladies and gentlemen. I've been around a long time. I'm a living history book. I saw it happen. And there was not one thing as one individual that I could do about it. It takes more than accommodation. It takes way more than accommodation. Damn blog talk. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, about the dead air. I hope you can hear me. My computer is acting up. It disconnected me from the internet and from the Blog Talk site. That's why the chat room went down. I'm trying to get it back up again before you end. My apologies for the delay in the show. Technology is a wonderful servant, but a very poor master. And technology is being not particularly kind to me right now. Ah, yes, you can hear me. Great. Sorry about that, folks. Looks like some of the excessive chat that was less than polite in the chat room created problems in traffic. So I'm glad to be back, and I'm glad that you all are here. So with a little luck, maybe we'll be able to get this put together again and get back to the point. But part of the reason that we are seeing the kind of behaviors that are happening in school, we can see the result of those behaviors if we look in our chat room. And unfortunately, I'm not taking calls tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize for that. I really do not want to go through the hassle of having to drop or mute or disconnect someone. And I am so sorry if you sincerely wish to call in and talk to me about the topic of the show or provide some insight or add some information. I would really, really, really like to talk with you. But I'm not here for the pleasure of people who, for whatever reason, think that the most fun thing they can do with a Thursday evening is harass someone on a internet radio show. I don't enjoy being harassed, and I really am not going to open myself to do it. For those of you who are here because you actually do want to listen or say something that's relevant, my apologies for not calling and speaking with you directly. Feel free to make your comment in the chat room, and those who wish to comment back are perfectly free to do so. For my friends from Patriot Families are here, who are here, thank you for joining me tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and I do apologize again for the break in the show. My biggest problem with the standards of behavior that we require in our public schools is not that we need to be understanding of children who truly do have a major problem with learning. We do need to understand that, and we do need to try to find ways to get across to them the knowledge that they need to be productive citizens, or even just to be able to live independently. But I'm also aware that our public school systems are being asked to do way more jobs than they were designed to do. What they were intended to do was to give an equal opportunity for everyone to learn what they could. without the barrier of the cost of attending school. Prior to the instigation or installation of public schools in most counties, cities, towns, etc., if you wanted schooling, a town or a village would hire a schoolmaster, and the village citizens would contribute to that schoolmaster's salary. The schoolmaster would teach all the children in the village or town and basically be boarded at the home of one of the scholar's parents, or, you know, his salary would pay for accommodation in a local inn or something of that nature. And if you didn't have the wherewithal in your village or town, or if you lived outside of town on a ranch or a farm and your children couldn't get there on a daily basis, you were pretty much barred from getting an education other than what mom and dad could give you at home. Our founding fathers understood that in order to have a free people, a people who are capable of self-control and self-government, and thus capable of governing themselves as a nation, they had to be educated. They had to be able to read, because understanding what was going on in other parts of the country came to them not through television and radio and the internet as we have it now, but through newspapers and periodicals and broadsides and brochures, or getting together in the taverns or restaurants or hotels or bars or town hall meetings or after church groups and talking about the news of the day. And this was how they understood what their legislators that they had elected and sent to their state house or Washington, what they were doing that their constituents wanted them to do. If we are choosing those who are going to make our laws, we need to keep track of what they're doing. We need to be able to know what they were putting into our laws, whether they were following our Constitution, what they were doing to our society and our nation that might change the way we did business or change the way we dealt with one another in the courts, or change the way that we paid for the services of government, or change which services government would provide for us and which we had to do as individuals or as smaller groups. In order to know these things, you had to be able to read. And that was the biggest point that the founding fathers wanted to stress in the need for public education. Reading and understanding what you read is the key to learning anything. There is only so much you can learn from word of mouth. That's always subject to the attitudes and behaviors and beliefs and manners of the individual talking. For example, some of the things that are being said in the chat room aren't teaching anybody anything because they make no sense and they're just babble. And that really doesn't educate anyone. It merely gratifies the ego of a very small-minded person who, for whatever reason, can't get attention any other way. And that kind of learning really doesn't benefit anybody. It does a lot the same things, very much the same things, as the disruptive student in class does. It prevents other people from learning anything. The unfortunate thing is that in the chat room, I can pretty much ignore this kind of behavior. I don't have to read it, I don't have to listen to it, and I certainly don't have to pick up a call from someone who makes remarks like some of these people. But a teacher in a classroom doesn't have that option. They used to be able to basically say, get out of the classroom, go home, go away. No, you're making it impossible for the rest of the children to learn. Now, we cannot do that, because even the most disruptive, ill-mannered, stupid, ignorant, willfully ignorant, and cruel person is still classified as someone with a behavioral or personality or psychological disability, and thus must be accommodated. That means that their peculiar behaviors have to be worked around. They can't be altered. They can't be disciplined, because that would somehow or other reduce that person's self-esteem or make them feel that they were not wanted and part of the group. And being part of the group, of course, in the progressive collective mentality is the one and only goal. That is the progressive view of education. It is radically different from the view our founding fathers held. Progressives do not see education as an opportunity. They do not see education as a way to rise above one's origins and do better than expected. They see education as a means of reforming the thinking patterns of the American public to the progressive ideal of we are all brothers, and if I have two pieces of bread and I'm hungry, I should give one to you because you only have one piece of bread and I have two, and that's not fair. So I should tear my second piece of bread in half and give you half so we both have the same amount of bread, even though you just ate a big lunch and aren't hungry right now. That is what education is for. It is in the progressive mindset. It is to make all of us love one another in spite of our differences, to make all of us kind to one another, to make all of us love each other so much that nobody will ever argue, nobody will ever have a disagreement, nobody will ever be different from anybody else, or if they are, will like it. That is the function of education in the progressive liberal mind. If our founding fathers were alive today, many of them would probably be out behind the barn throwing up, sickened at what their idealism and their belief in the dignity of mankind has led to. When we spend a great deal of time concentrating on the worst aspects of humanity and trying to make the best aspects of humanity feel sorry for the worst aspects of humanity, what kind of a world are we creating? What kind of citizens are we nurturing and teaching? What are we teaching those who have been brought up to believe that they should behave like ladies and gentlemen? Why are people offended by being thought of as ladies and gentlemen? Why is that politically incorrect? Is it politically incorrect because someone's going to assume that you are endowing someone else with a degree of nobility or membership in a peerage which our classless society is not allowed to have? Well, how many people who get offended at being called a lady have as much knowledge of history to understand what a peerage and nobility are? You can only be offended by something you don't understand if somebody else tells you that it's offensive. Being called a lady has absolutely nothing to do with who your parents were and whether they were earls, dukes, baronets, or whatever. Being called a lady is a compliment to your ability to treat others with the kind of respect you wish to receive. That's what being a lady is. That's what being a gentleman is. And I believe that's what being a good person is. We had a Christmas dance at our middle school last week, and the sixth graders' dance was immediately after school, and the seventh and eighth graders' dance was from 6 p.m. till 8 p.m. in the evening. All the students had to have signed permission slips from their parents to attend the dance, the sixth graders in particular, because they were staying after school. And even though we were not running our activity buses, we don't on a Friday, and the parents were responsible for transportation, in order for us to be basically out from under the liability of anything that might happen to them, we had to have parental consent for them to be in the school building after school hours were over. We also had to have parental permission slips because they were a tacit acceptance of the dress code for the dance. because if we didn't have one, many of our young ladies, and I use the term advisedly, would show up in garments that were suitable for a lady of the evening or a star of a porn flick. And, of course, there were many complaints about the dress code, which said that if you wore a strapless dress or a dress with spaghetti straps, you were supposed to wear a shawl or a throw or a jacket over it for the evening. Because, after all, this was a quote-unquote semi-formal dance, not a lingerie show. We also had a deadline. Students were handed or were given the permission slips to take home 8 days before the dance was held. The Thursday of the week before the dance, which was held on a week from the Friday after they got the permission slips, they were to be turned in on the Wednesday before the dance, so that the school and the dance organizers and the refreshment committee and so on and so forth would have time to determine how much of what they needed and give us a chance to know how many people were coming and make sure that we had the cafeteria decorated, and if we were going to have a larger crowd, maybe move the dance into the gym and so on and so forth. And students who did not turn in their permission slip on time by the Wednesday due date were only allowed to turn it in late if they had been absent on that day, which was pretty generous considering they'd had 7 days to turn it in. Well, we had about three or four of them who decided that they could turn it in on the morning of the dance, and they were told they could not attend. And I found out that one of the parents brought the child anyway, after receiving a phone call and an explanation of why they were not permitted to attend, and stood on the balcony of our third floor of our school, loudly making disparaging remarks about the school, the teachers, the other children, and anything and everything she could think of as her way of paying back the school for not being fair to her child. She wanted that level playing field. Well, it's not her fault. She forgot. Too bad. If they aren't going to learn that if something's due on this day, that's when you have to turn it in, what happens when they get out there in the workforce? What happens when their employer says, we've got to have this report done by next week? What's going to happen? What's going to happen when they are responsible for themselves? And they're the ones who have to remember to do something. Because if they don't remember to take out the garbage, okay? For example. And pretty soon, the whole house stinks. Am I supposed to go into their house and remind them to when they're 35? Apparently, this mother assumes that her child is somehow going to learn personal responsibility if somebody else takes it off her shoulders all the time. I'm sorry she couldn't go to the dance. But doggone it, if you don't do things the way they're supposed to be done, there are 99% of the time negative consequences to somebody, including yourself. The behaviors that we see in classrooms are there and continue because we're not allowed to give negative consequences that mean anything. We are handcuffed. We cannot have expectations that our students will behave as reasonable people. We cannot expect them to listen when we teach. We cannot expect them to respect the other students in class so that they can hear when we teach. We cannot expect them to turn in their assignments on time. We cannot even expect them to turn them in at all. Because when a student doesn't turn in their homework, doesn't study for tests, and gets an F, the parents call up and blame the teacher. And yes, I overheard one of my best friends, who's a teacher at the school, fielding that same kind of garbage from a parent today when I was in the teacher's lounge. Well, it's your fault. He works hard at home. Well, he doesn't do anything in the classroom. Well, that's because you're not doing it right. Okay, what is it that you want me to do to make this child do the work that's in front of him? Instead of getting up and sharpening his pencil 8 times, going to the bathroom 4 times, talking to his neighbor, playing with a Rubik's Cube or a toy car, eating a snack, staring at the ceiling, or falling asleep. What is it that you expect the teacher to do with that? How are we to teach someone who comes to class expecting to be able to behave as if he were at home in his bedroom or his living room or his playroom or out at the park? When I was a little girl going to school, I was told that when I was in school, my job was to sit quietly and listen to the teacher and to ask questions if I didn't understand and to treat my teacher with respect because my teacher knew more about the subject than I did. Apparently, there are a great many parents out there who don't teach that to their kids. I don't understand why they don't. I kind of have a glimmering, because we spend a lot of time blaming teachers for the failure of our public school, that there's a perception among people that all teachers are either incredibly lazy or incredibly stupid or only teaching because they think it's a soft job and they're just collecting a paycheck and sleeping the entire day. Because we hear about some that are. And yes, there are some that are. We hear about things like the notorious rubber rooms in New York, where teachers who have been suspended go sit and run their own businesses on the city's dime. They're paid their full salary to sit in a room all day and read newspapers or play on the internet or do stock trading via Wi-Fi. And they get paid to do that. And that's horrible. But that isn't every teacher. And believe me, it doesn't happen in my little rural county in Virginia. But we are, all those of us who work with kids, under the same insane oxymoronic rules that tell us that we have to put up with inappropriate behaviors, inattention, unwillingness to put forth effort, because the student can't help it. And somehow or other, if we were just better at our job, we would all of a sudden turn them around and they would be eager and anxious to learn and do every bit of work simply because we were teaching them right. I would really, really one day love to have an experimental hidden camera in some of our classrooms and invite the parents of the students to a closed meeting so they could watch what their dear, precious, adorable darling did in a classroom. And I wonder, do they really get by with that at home? My guess is that they don't. Because mom and dad are stricter at home than we're allowed to be in school. I don't know of an easy button solution, ladies and gentlemen, because I don't believe in the easy button, for one thing. And for another, I can't think of a quick fix to the mess that our schools are in. But I can think of some things we can do incrementally to make them better. We can start really looking at what we expect from education. What is it that you want when you send your kids to school? Do you want them to be petted and babysat and given an A simply because they're your kid? Or do you want them to learn something? Do you want to talk to their teacher to blame their teacher if the kid's grades are bad? Or do you want to talk with their teacher about why their kid's grades are bad? And teachers, do you want to talk with the parent and be honest with them instead of politically correct? Not in a hurtful way, but in an honest way. Instead of, oh, Jimmy's doing wonderfully, he got an A in English. And he got the A in English because he finally figured out how to spell January the same way twice. I was talking to a teacher last year who's a special education teacher and is a caseworker for a special education student whose accommodations include having tests read out loud to her, and when it's a multiple choice test, as 99% of them are, blacking out or crossing off one of the four possible choices so she only has to pick from three instead of four. And encouragement and help narrowing it down to two from the person reading the test, who was taking the standards of learning test. And last year, the standards of learning for the first time in our state were not solely multiple choice. They included, in English, essay questions where the student actually had to write and put into words the answer to the prompt. And this child, as with the other special education students, was given the questions to take home and practice before she came back to school to take the actual test. The mother called up outraged and wrote a scathing letter about how unkind it was to expect this of her when it was so difficult. And couldn't we do something that would make her feel better about it because it was really hard for her and she was upset because she couldn't really do it. And so she could pass her SOLs and go to the next grade. I really do not understand how any parent, would do that to their child. And I don't understand how they would do that to this teacher who works her heart out to try to help these kids learn what they're capable of learning. Who goes over every test to try to make it more comprehensible so they can understand, goes over the notes with them, takes them in small groups to go over the material, who cares that they learn, and is criticized by a parent for not making it easier so that this kid can pass to the next grade without the skills of the grade she's in. As if passing, as if advancing to the next year, somehow or other was the same as actually knowing more than she did when she walked in the door in September. Apparently, this parent sees school as a place for her child to be told she's wonderful and see other kids all day, and to do something that looks like what everybody else is doing so she'll feel part of the group. This is a very progressive parent, ladies and gentlemen. This child, very likely, will remain a child for her whole life. And if she's fortunate enough not to outlive her parents, she'll probably be very happy and very well cared for and very much loved. And for that, I'm glad. But if that parent expects her child to be able to live independently and function on her own, that parent is killing that possibility. It may be that she will not be able to live on her own. It may be that she will need to remain dependent because her learning skills and maturation, mental maturation level, may not get past 12 or 13. There are some children for whom that happens. And yes, it's sad. But that is not a reason to hold the public education system hostage to make that child feel good at the expense of a teacher being able to teach a whole class. Because letters like that and attitudes like that, because administrators are terrified that they are going to get sued, could lose that teacher her job. It has happened to teachers. Lawsuits have been brought against schools because the parents of a child with special needs or a child who can't behave say that the school has not met the federal laws that say the school must adapt to the child and not the child to the school. It's kind of like what we saw in Michigan with the passage of the Right to Work law. It's another form of thuggery. It's another form of bullying. It's another attempt by the coalition of atheists to ban Christmas because they're offended by the idea that there's a God. It's another bar to the freedoms that we take for granted. Because you can't be free if you're not allowed to say something that may potentially offend somebody. Sorry if what I say offends someone. It is not my intention to offend anyone. If you are offended by my ideas, that's not my problem. It's yours. I might be offended by your ideas. I doubt it because I'm not offended by ideas at all. I merely think they make sense or they don't. And the fact that somebody has ideas that don't make sense doesn't offend me. Frustrates me occasionally, annoys me quite often, but offends me? No. Because I don't assume that everybody in the world thinks the way I do, wants the same things that I want in esoteric areas, behaves exactly the same way, believes exactly the same things, comes from the same culture. I know they don't. I have absolutely no problem with other people, okay? Having a different opinion from mine. But I am not going to agree with their opinion simply to avoid offending them if I think it's ridiculous. I have too much self-respect for that. And if I inadvertently offend somebody by espousing an opinion that they dislike or don't believe in, I apologize, but I certainly am not going to stop giving my opinion. You can always go somewhere else, just like with this radio show. If you don't like what I say, if you don't agree, that's fine. And if you wish to talk to me about the topic and agree or disagree, I'll be happy to talk with you. If you in the chat room or even online, on the phone. But if all you want to do is to harass, make stupid remarks, use profanity, be insulting, then why are you here? If you don't like it, you don't have to listen. And if I don't like what you say, I don't have to talk to you. Hopefully, some of you who do like what I say, or at least might disagree with me, but are more interested in sharing a different viewpoint than in making insulting remarks, will join us again next Thursday for Patriot Education and call in or visit the chat room and express your opinion about the topic or your opinion about a related topic and agree or disagree, because freedom of speech doesn't mean that everybody has to agree with you. It merely means that everybody has the same right to express their opinion as you do. You don't have to listen to mine, and I don't have to listen to yours. I hope that those of you out there who have been listening will visit our website at www.patriotfamilies.com, where you will meet some great people who believe in the ideals that our founding fathers wove into our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, that every individual deserves opportunity, that all human beings are created equal under the law, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that every individual should be free to follow his own spiritual path, that every individual should have the right to have a say in how he or she is governed, and that every individual should have the opportunity to become as educated as their capabilities allow. Patriot Education is not only a show about the state of our public schools. It's about what education means to a patriot. What's it for? Why do patriots need education? And why does education need patriots? If you can think about those questions and figure out your own answers and your own beliefs, and you want to share them with us, come and join us every Thursday night at 7 p.m. for Patriot Education here on Blog Talk Radio, or visit us for one of our other talk shows on Mondays, Constitution Hour with my friend Ron Goldman, on Tuesdays, Patriot Family Chat with Bill Strong, on Wednesdays, Right from the Left Coast with that beautiful bird of paradise from California, the rare bird indeed, a California conservative, Linda Sills, Thursdays, of course, for Patriot Education, Fridays with Foreclosure Help, Saturdays with Breaking the Illusion, and Sundays with Frank is Fed Up. We have a show for everybody, ladies and gentlemen, a place to give us your ideas, listen to ours, agree, disagree, engage in dialogue so that we can all learn from one another, so that we can learn and teach, because all of us are teachers. We teach by what we do as well as what we say. Our acts define us much more than our words do. And if we are going to maintain the kind of freedom and prosperity that we have known for the last 100 years or so, we have got to pay attention to the way we teach our children. Not just what we teach them, as far as academics go, but what we teach them about expectations. What we teach them about behaviors, values, beliefs, behaviors, attitudes, expectations, values, morals and ethics. And we have to figure out where the parental role stops and starts, and where the public education role stops and starts. Are we looking to our public schools to be parents, grandparents, babysitters, spiritual counselors, psychologists, coaches, or teachers? Are we looking to parents to be biological baby-producing machines who then hand the child over to the state? Are we looking to parents to be teachers and nurturers of their children, so that when they're ready to enter the educational system, they understand the kinds of behaviors that are appropriate so that everyone can learn? And they understand that learning is a good thing. And they understand that learning requires effort on the part of the learner as well as the teacher. We can change the system, ladies and gentlemen. Not necessarily by getting up on a soapbox and screaming at them for the things they're doing wrong, but by going to our school board meetings, becoming members of the parent-teacher organizations, listening to what our kids are reading in the classroom, talking with them about their day. Not just sticking them in a corner with a book and saying, okay, go do your homework. Because in order to be a learner, a lifelong learner, a child has to have somebody around them who is also a lifelong learner. Don't shy away from helping your kids with homework because it's been too long since you were in school. Make that your reason for joining in on the homework. You can learn something too. The things that are in textbooks now were not even discovered when I was in middle school. Now, DNA and its structure and how it works and all of the amino acids that make it up are standard fare for seventh graders. My high school biology taught about it from Scientific American because Watson and Crick's discovery was only 6 years before I was in high school. Be a lifelong learner and help your children be too. Good night, all. Have a wonderful evening.